Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Casey Wagner. Wagner is the director of workplace issues at Cornell University's ILR Metro District Office in New York City. She has specialized in the prevention of sexual harassment, gender bias, and promoting inclusiveness in the workplace for over 28 years. Since 1996, she has also co-chaired the New York Labor Union Coalition Against Domestic Violence and is a founding member of Safe at Work Coalition. Thank you. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, your expertise is in the realm of sexual harassment and domestic violence. But was there anything in particular that prompted you to get involved in these issues?
When I was a graduate social work student in 1978, my assignment was to take an idea of a community-based response to domestic violence and turn it into a reality. And so that introduced me to an issue that I think I experienced as a woman, but never quite had a name or a label to put to it. And so it really opened my eyes to a phenomenon that I thought was just my personal issue. And then I saw it in a broader community context. And so as a graduate social work student, I worked with the community to create this Park Slope Safe Homes Project in Brooklyn, which was a model of a community response, burnt out as a staff person, and was looking for another job and looked in the New York Times and I saw this ad for an organization dealing with sexual harassment on the job. So this continuum of violence was now presented as an employment opportunity in another venue. And so I was totally burnt out, and I thought, oh, maybe it's not going to be as stressful. So I'm going to explore this.
And that's amazing that you had the strength to continue with this issue.
Well, it resonated. I remember when I was a student in geometry class, my geometry professor would constantly touch my hair and flirt with me, and I felt uncomfortable, and I would move in different locations in the classroom, and I thought I earned a D in geometry, and he gave me a B. I insisted on going to summer school for that, and people said, why are you going to summer school for? Your teacher gave you a B. I knew in my heart I deserved a D, and I thought that my silence in saying nothing for his flirting and touching my hair was this sort of quid pro quo, that he was rewarding me for keeping my mouth shut. So that experience got defined for me in a very different way when I started working at this community-based program called Working Women's Institute. That was the ad that I answered in the Times, and I was the counseling director there. And I counseled hundreds of women dealing with this concept of sexual harassment. What was sexual harassment? It was this new phenomenon that was just being defined and understood.
Oh, that's amazing. Now, let's begin with the talk about sexual harassment. Well, what constitutes sexual harassment? Some people think it's common sense, but tell us.
There are two types of sexual harassment, and they all have to do with power in exchange for sexual behavior or advances, or the toleration of a work environment that is replete with sexual comments, innuendos, and remarks. One is called, in the old days it was called quid pro quo, which was this for that. You put out for your employer and they reward you, or you object to it and they punish you. But now it's called tangible employment consequences because there's some kind of economic exchange, benefit, or loss. The second aspect of this is called hostile work environment, which is often in traditionally male work environments where the environment is replete with sexual comments, remarks, visual materials of a sexual nature, and the behavior can be directed toward you by coworkers as well as supervisors. And again, it's the tolerance of that in exchange for your employment there. And if you object to that, you're going to lose something as it relates to employment.
You know what I want to ask you? In this day and age when there are more and more women bosses and women-run organizations and so on, is it as prevalent? When you talk about male-dominated environments where sexual harassment is happening, does it happen as much when there are a lot more women at the top?
It's an abuse of power. So women can abuse power as much as men can, and overwhelmingly, men are in positions of power and authority, and overwhelmingly, women are still entering traditionally male work environments. Even if the numbers are changing, the norms of the workplace still prevail.
So it doesn't make that much difference. Now, how prevalent do we know sexual harassment is still in the workplace, even after all these years of education?
It's still a pervasive phenomenon. The forms are different. In the early days of the issue, in when we first started looking at this issue, and I was the counseling director at Working Women's Institute starting in 1980, it was much more characteristically the quid pro quo. And it was much more obvious behavior. Now it's getting more subtle. And sometimes it's more difficult to identify because the more obvious behaviors, people have been trained about this and they've been talking about this and thinking about this for almost, 30 years?
30 years at least.
And so the more obvious is not as prevalent, but it still happens. And it's the more subtle behaviors. And the recent Supreme Court cases look at the retaliation. So I may object to the behavior. My organization has the obligation to develop policies and procedures. They're going to resolve it. However, if I'm retaliated against for complaining about it, that is the more, that seems to be what we're looking at in terms of the prevailing cases. And what we're seeing also is sexual harassment that doesn't necessarily have to do with sexual interest or orientation. It has to do with sex being the MO, the modus operandi, to intimidate or harass someone on the job.
Oh.
So what the Supreme Court said in an important case, the Oncal case, said sexual interest and sexual orientation doesn't matter. It's the nature of the behavior in and of itself. So men can harass men and women can harass women.
That's interesting that they figured that one out in some ways. Now, what are some of the common coping strategies for women who are feeling like they're being victimized by these behaviors?
I testify in court as an expert witness and testify to common coping strategies because of my extensive experience as a counseling director, anecdotal evidence and experience in all those years that I've done this work. And so here's the four strategies or four components of what constitutes a strategy. Number one, what is my conflict style? Number two, what is my cost-benefit analysis of speaking up or keeping my mouth shut? Speaking up, meaning am I going to be retaliated against, or am I going to see that my organization is going to respond? Or should I keep my mouth shut until it gets really bad because I see that if you speak out, you could be potentially retaliated against? So I'm going to wait until it gets really bad before I address it. So that's my cost-benefit analysis.
Mm-hmm.
The third is, what is the track record of the organization? How have I observed it addressing and resolving this issue? So if they're going to be supportive and responsive and nip it in the bud, I might approach someone within the chain of command to address the issue. If I see people being retaliated against in subtle ways, then I may keep my mouth shut. So how is the organization's track record going to make it easier for me to speak out or going to keep my make me quiet? And then the fourth is, who are the resources available for me to deal with? Are there union folks I can talk to? Are there managers, supervisors, ombuds? What's that complaint mechanism? And employers have an obligation to create multiple points of entry for individuals to address the issue that comes out of the first case that went before the Supreme Court called Michelle Vincent versus Meritor Savings Bank.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that.
That was the first case that went before the Supreme Court in 1986. I was in the courtroom.
Really?
When this was being argued, I was a nervous wreck. And not only was I in the courtroom with my sisters from Working Women's Institute, but the fourth grade class of some Midwestern town was also in there. And
great education.
Fabulous education, because it talked about an individual employee, Michelle Vincent, who had sex with her boss 30 to 40 times. She had sex with him. And so the issue was addressed about what is the consequence of power. And so one of the key issues that came out of this was voluntary behavior doesn't mean it was welcome to begin with. The concept of unwelcome behavior was defined. And the assumption was, well, if I'm Michelle Vincent and someone wants to have sex with me, all I have to do is say no. Well, guess what? I can't say no to my boss if they can penalize me in some way or reward me for saying yes.
Mm-hmm.
So what the Supreme Court said, voluntary behavior doesn't mean it was welcome to begin with. It is inherently unwelcome because a supervisor has the power to impose employment consequences, inherently unwelcome.
Wow.
So supervisor's behavior is held to a higher standard. Has nothing to do with Casey Wagner's ability to be assertive. It has to do with Casey Wagner's assessment of what is the consequence of me speaking out.
Or saying no.
Mm-hmm. Supervisors are held to a higher standard. And the other was, Sidney Taylor, who was the supervisor, was the only person that Michelle Vinson could complain to. Because the bank said, hey, we took seriously the EEOC guidelines in 1980 that said we have to prevent sexual harassment, we have to have a policy and procedure. So we're going to have a policy and procedure, and Sidney Taylor is going to be the one you have to complain to.
Oh.
Well, guess what? The bank said that the mere existence of a policy and procedure doesn't insulate an employer from liability. It needs to be designed to encourage people to come forward. So there needs to be multiple points of entry in any policy and procedure so that I can choose who I feel comfortable complaining to within an organizational structure.
I was wondering what happens if the boss is the one that's doing the victimizing. Interesting that the Supreme Court had such vision.
Well, they had vision because they had amicus briefs from women's organizations that made them see the light of day.
Yeah, that's great. Now, let's talk about domestic violence. Tell us some of the definitions. I mean, physical violence is the one that everybody thinks of, but there's so much more. Talk to us about financial withholding and so on.
You have just hit the nail on the head. Because, oh, there's that violent metaphor here. Okay.
That's okay.
The assumption, if it's not physical abuse, it's not domestic violence. Mm. And what the advocates have understood and communicated is that it's a range of behaviors, psychological, physical, economic, in addition to physical.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a pattern of coercive behavior. That has
some of it's verbal.
It's verbal.
Isolating the person.
And so one of the projects that I worked on with a group of unions in the labor union coalition was, how do we get this word out? And so what we did was we put together an incredibly colorful brochure that depicts a variety of different poses of people, particularly women, because overwhelmingly 85% of all the targets of sexual harassment are women. That doesn't mean that men can't be abused as well. And obviously it happens in same-sex relationships as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we want to do was depict the range of behaviors so people recognize themselves in these posters, because it's so important for the workplace to address this issue so that individuals who experience it don't feel like they've got to be triple jeopardized. First, I'm victimized by it. Second, if it spills into the workplace and it has an impact on productivity, performance, job security, I have to deal with the consequences of that, and then I may be retaliated against. But here's the definitions. Here are some of the definitions that are on this poster that's available free.
Okay.
Going out with friends and family, forget about it. So it's that social control. With the constant calls checking up on me, I can't get any of my work done. So now my performance is being interfered with by constant calls. Now let's talk about text messaging. Let's talk about the emailing. Let's talk about all of those
control ways of controlling.
Aspects through these
checking
current
up on somebody constantly so they can barely move or breathe, right?
Exactly. But if I'm your coworker and I'm sitting next to you and you're getting constant calls on the job, and I rely on you to perform because we're working on a team, suddenly it has an impact on me. Suddenly your personal issue spilling into the workplace, having an impact on your productivity, is now going to affect me.
Indeed.
Here's something that's really important, the threats of physical violence. But so he actually never hits me, but he throws things and just not at the wall. So, or one of our union folks had a member whose partner cut up her uniform and threw it out on the lawn for all the neighbors to see.
Good heavens.
And what's interesting about that is you have to educate men as well, because we had a situation where two men in a garage, traditionally male work environment, were overhearing, well, they had a buddy who said to them, I'd rather kill the bee than let her leave me. And they're surprised that he had that comment. They looked like such a happy couple. They had seen them at union events together. And she's going to leave me. I'll show you who's boss. And then he started describing he broke her Lamose china collection. He cut up the uniforms that she left because she left the house. And he still was talking about getting even with her. He ended up stalking her at the job and murdering her.
Oh, my gosh. If you're just joining us, my guest is Casey Wagner. Wagner is the Director of Workplace Issues at Cornell University's ILR Metro District Office in New York City. Let's continue on that vein. What are some of the barriers for women to actually be able to leave these situations of domestic violence?
Two important issues. One, leaving a domestic violence situation often creates more opportunity for fatal injury and death because you're challenging this issue of power and control. And for those women or individuals who choose to leave, it often takes 8 times to leave.
Really?
Resources, disrupting the family. I've got no other place to live. I can't live too far away from my job because how am I going to get to job if I'm relying on public transportation or if I have to travel 2 hours because I'm now relocating to a shelter to get to my job? That's going to be a consequence. Loss of family support. Blaming you for breaking up the family.
Oh, yeah. We've heard that one. And also, I know a lot of women who are lacking in resources. They've either never been in the workforce. They're older. How does one deal with that?
I think that is a very important component of that. So that I've never worked outside the home, or I've retired, or I'm living on a fixed income, or I'm relying on this secondary income to survive, and I'm ashamed and embarrassed to talk to anybody about it. And so what's so important is to reach out to community organizations and the importance of a joint workplace community response to domestic violence so that the issue gets raised in the context of the work environment, and then the resources that are available in the community are made known to people so that they know that there may be other options and strategies to pursue.
Mm-hmm. How important would it be for a woman? We were talking about how isolated a lot of them are, but if they have a good friend who can help support them, does that make the outcome better usually when someone has someone to rely on like that?
You're raising a couple of very important issues. Number one, it's important to train everyone that judgment is a negative, and that the best that you can do is be supportive without judgment. For some people, one time abuse and they're gone. For other people, it may take 8 times to leave, and there may be some people who aren't going to leave.
Yeah.
So that's important. The other is, and we do this training in the workplace, about a strategy of say what you see, show support, show concern, and refer. So let's say I notice a friend of mine is suddenly nervous and used to go to all these committee meetings that we had or used to socialize with us, and suddenly they're nervous. Or how about this? She's now unable to travel beyond the radius of home and work because her husband is now tracking her mileage. And she's telling me this. So I'm going to I may know that's a sign of domestic violence because I've been educated. So I might say, you know, I'm really concerned about that. That's probably something that's really difficult to deal with. You don't have to deal with that by yourself. There are other people that you can talk to address that.
Mm-hmm.
And she may say, oh, it's my problem. I'll deal with it. But I've now identified that I'm concerned. I'm not making a judgment. I'm letting her know that I know about other resources that are available. And when she's ready to come and talk with me, I can then make those suggestions and referrals of resources.
Mm-hmm. And what about the fact that you're now making it part of how it affects the workplace? That seems to be a really important issue right now, too.
In times of economic insecurity, domestic violence increases. In times of that the economic crisis that we're all facing, people may be reluctant to rock the boat because they need housing, and so they may be reluctant to address situations that are difficult. And so in the workplace, it's so important to be proactive to address this issue through education,
mm-hmm.
because it's going to have an impact on productivity, performance, and job security.
Mm-hmm. And coworkers.
And there was a recent study. Corporate Alliance Against Partner Violence has sponsored a lot of fabulous studies.
Mm-hmm.
One study talked about coworkers who know about this issue of domestic violence. Nobody now in our culture can put their head in the sand because you either know someone, have been told about it, or read about it in the paper. So everyone knows domestic violence.
Or have seen it in films,
seen it
on TV.
Right.
It's prevalent. Yeah.
And so it's an issue. And coworkers in this survey were open to being supportive. There was a small percentage who resented it, but overwhelmingly, over 50% said, I would be happy to be supportive to a coworker. I just don't know what to do or say.
But the other people are probably those the kinds of people you know about in society that say, I don't want to get involved. right? Period.
Right.
Whether they would care or not. They just don't want to get involved. Now, one of the fallacies in regard to domestic violence is the woman often thinks that the abuser is going to change somehow. If she changes her behavior, is nicer to him, cooks his favorite meals. To talk to us about that myth.
That is a very important myth, and that is a variation on blaming the victim. So what are you doing to provoke that violence?
Right.
And what we know is that the only one who can stop the violence is the one who's perpetrating it. And what we know is that because it's an issue of power and control, nothing I can do is going to change your response. You, if you're the perpetrator or you're the person with violent behavior, can choose not to do that.
Yeah, that's the tough side of this.
Very tough.
To find one of these guys. And a lot of this is based on insecurity or somebody who's also been abused too, right? I mean, these men who abuse are just continuing a pattern,
you know,
a learned pattern.
What is so interesting, and we have this on our poster, is his father did it to his mother, he's doing it to me. Is this what I want my kids to learn? Mm-hmm. So one of the corollaries is, as a child, seeing that in your family and assuming that that's either what love is mm-hmm. or that's the way that is acceptable. And so the issue of consequence for that behavior is why it's so important to engage men as allies to address this issue.
Mm-hmm.
Because creating this new norm of what is appropriate behavior is so key, and men using their influence as peers with other men who are not supportive of violence is a good way to stop that assumption that all men do it or all men agree with it.
Yeah, that's key, that all men agree with it. Now, domestic violence isn't just about men losing their tempers, right? It really is a set of behaviors that you can identify. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yes, it's a pattern of behaviors, and the goal is power and control. So I'm going to do it economically, I'm going to do it verbally, I'm going to do it physically, I'm going to threat to do it physically. And so it's a series of behaviors that is a pattern of power and control.
And would you say it's calculated in some ways?
Oh, sure. Sure. Now, people make it the confusion. Oh, just send them to anger management. It's not about anger management.
Exactly.
It's about choosing who I'm going to direct that anger to and what's the consequence. In a culture that either says it's a private issue and we don't have any right to say anything, or it's your business, or maybe what is it that you've done to deserve it, then people feel they've got no consequences. But if you raise this to an issue where it's not tolerated and it's spoken about in the community and in the workplace, and men and women are engaged as allies to address it, then there's no longer the silence about it, and there's no longer the hidden aspect about it. We all have a role and responsibility to play.
So much of a stigma.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about this important project that you worked on called Stand Up Guys. It's very interesting to me. Talk to us about that.
That project has captured people's imagination because what it is, it's a photographic essay of men across the state who have partnered with women and local service providers to take a stand against male violence against women. And so what we're profiling are an intergenerational, multiracial group of men who have used their own peer authority and power, like the two teenagers in the high school, or have used their power and authority within the workplace, like the union president, who has worked with management to bring training to a predominantly male workforce on safety and health time that was negotiated in the contract.
Wow.
To the individual who owns a self-defense studio in Rochester who got hooked on this because his sister was a victim of abuse and violence, to the men and women in the diversity committee at Cornell University in the campus life department who developed a skit to address the issue of domestic violence in the workplace. Each of them, in their own way, within their own role and responsibility, have done things to take a public stand against violence against women. And when men speak out, holding men as peers accountable, or engaging men who are allies, not to be silent bystanders, and to take a stand against male violence against women, what we're really doing is maximizing the reach of who has a role and responsibility to play.
Mm-hmm. And that's powerful for men to get involved in this.
It is.
There's no
so
other way
powerful.
To really get to some of these men, I would assume.
Because the messenger is as important as the message. And if it's only assumed to be a women's issue because women are targets, then no one else feels I have a role and responsibility to play. Mm-hmm. Men have a stake in this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How did you recruit the guys for this project, Stand Up Guys? Well, where did they come from?
These men come from partnerships that we've had with a variety of different people up and down the state. And part of Cornell's role in dealing with this is to do capacity building, develop training materials, to give people the means and mechanisms to do their own education and outreach and organizing. So the union president came through a joint labor management initiative through their work family initiative, and we partnered with a very important group in New York City called Connect, because they were dealing with changing the culture in a community context, and we brought it into the workplace, and that's where peer influence had a very important role. The concept of stand-up guys came from a group of men in Rochester who organized themselves to stand up as men. And Hank Shaw, who was the writer of this fabulous project, was able to recruit two really talented people, one of whom was an award-winning photographer and then an award-winning graphic artist, to develop this visual essay.
Mm-hmm.
And the concept stand-up guys came out of their own organizing. And we thought there are stand-up guys up and down the state. And the goal of this is for people to look through this.
It's a booklet.
It's a booklet,
Let's
right.
Call it a
right.
booklet, yeah.
Six men or groups of men are profiled. And the idea is to look at that booklet and say, hey, that looks like me. Or, hey, they're doing something. What could I do in my workplace? What could I do in my union? What could I do in my community? Mm-hmm. Oh, I could do something like that.
Mm-hmm. And we only have about 1 minute left. Now, you began this work 24 years ago, and did you believe it that when you started this that we'd be able to eradicate domestic violence and sexual harassment? And how do you feel about where we are at this 21st century mark?
You know, people say to me, you've done this for almost 30 years.
Yeah.
You seem so optimistic. And what gives you energy? And I say to folks, you give me energy because I've seen changes. I've seen policies change. I've seen employers take this on. I've seen unions take this on. I've seen people empowered to address this. I've seen individuals in the workplace as allies to take a stand with other coworkers who were doing this kind of behavior, both in the terms of sexual harassment and domestic violence. And of course, this is also linked to race, religion, national origin, and color.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen people make a difference.
So we've made progress.
We've made progress.
That's
There's a lot more work to do,
Absolutely.
But I'm a half glass full kind of person.
That's great. Now, can you give us a website or something in which people can get in touch?
To get in touch about domestic violence, I would suggest calling the New York State Coalition Against Domestic Violence, and that is 1-800-942-6906, and their web is www.nyscadv.org, and the New York State Office for the Prevention of Domestic Violence, 518-457-5800, and that's www.opdv.state.newyork.us, and also contacting me at kcw8@cornell.edu.
Great. Well, Casey Wagner, thank you so much for joining us and giving us so much really important information. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes in Corning, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.